The privilege of being able to be together, to look into your word, to be challenged and encouraged from your word. I pray you'd help us to not just see this as an academic pursuit, but really see this as an opportunity to know you better, and by knowing you better than to know ourselves. I pray that you would help us to be excited that we have the privilege and freedom to do what we're doing here this morning, and I pray that you would never help us never take that as a given, but to protect that freedom and liberty. Lord, thank you for our time together. We ask that you would be working in the lives of those who are here and those who are not quite here yet. I pray that those who are struggling through difficulties, that you would show yourself faithful to them. I pray for those who are walking through prosperity, that you'd help them recognize that it's not anything they've done for themselves, but it's your gift to them. And I pray you'd help us as a people to rejoice with those who are rejoicing and to weep with those who are weeping, and that we would come alongside and truly be the family that you desire us to be. We ask this all in your name. Amen. All right, we are in the book of Exodus. We are working our way from Egypt to Sinai, and we've been doing this for a while. So we're right now, we've walked through getting across the sea. We've walked through the lack of water. We've walked through the lack of food. We've walked through the lack of water again. And now we approach ourselves. We're going to be coming against the first real military test for the people here in Exodus chapter 17. This is a big deal. I think this is one of the bigger deals that they face, especially as, remember what's going on here. What's going on here right now is God is using this period of time in their life to prepare them for that time coming up in Numbers 13 where they're going to be on the verge of entering the land and they're going to be confronted with a big obstacle. And the big obstacles are going to be giants in the land and the fear of those giants. And so I think what God is doing is throughout this series of events on the way to Sinai is showing them that not only can he deliver, but he will deliver and he will accomplish what he desires to accomplish. Remember back in earlier in the book, he said, I will be your God. You'll be my people. I will be your God. And so what he's doing for them is I think, demonstrating faithfulness over and over and over again as they come up against real difficulty. And I think that's also important. Remember, we said there are three things as we walk through each one of these events on the way to Sinai that I think are something that are important for us to remember is first of all, difficulty really is difficulty. 3 days without water is a real problem. No food is a real problem. Again, no water is a real problem. Or no good water, no water at all is a real problem. The fact that there's an enemy coming against you and you're not necessarily a well-trained military unit yet, that fact is a real problem. And even the difficulty of trying to negotiate or trying to lead 2 million people as one individual, that's a real problem. And so you have this real problem after real problem after real problem that come up, and yet every situation, not only is God able to accomplish what he said he would, but he does accomplish what he says he would. So remember, first of all, difficulty really is difficulty. So whatever it is you're facing as you're walking through life, even this morning, there's no reason to negotiate that difficulty away or to make it seem less than it is. I think a lot of times what the idea that we give as we counsel or comfort someone is, it's really not that big of a deal because God's got a plan. Well, be careful because it really is a big deal. And I think sometimes we cheapen God's work in our lives because we lessen the deal and we make it not such a big deal. It is a big deal, the thing, whatever it is you're going through. It is a big deal. Difficulty really is difficulty. The second truth to remember in all these situations is that God has you exactly where he wants you. That's no accident. The reason you find yourself where you are is not accidental, nor is it a surprise to God. Remember, he is now, right now, leading the Israelites with a pillar of cloud or pillar of smoke in day and a pillar of fire by night. And so it is not an accident they find themselves 3 days without water. It's not an accident they find themselves in a place where there's no food. It's not an accident they find themselves without water again. It's not an accident that the Amalekites come up against them. And it's not an accident that Moses is trying to lead 2 million people by himself. None of these things are accidents. God is directing them. God is directly leading them into and through these situations. So the first thing, remember, difficulty is really difficulty. Second thing, remember, is God has you exactly where he wants you, that this is not a surprise for him, that he is accomplishing a purpose. And ultimately, we know because of Romans 8, we know that purpose is to glorify himself and to make you like him. And there's no greater purpose. There's no greater purpose. You know, the Westminster Catechism, what's the purpose of man? To glorify God and enjoy him forever, right? That's what's going on here. God is at work helping you learn how to glorify him, enjoy him forever. He's about his glory and he's about your good. So he's got you exactly where he wants you. This is not an accidental situation for him. So that's the second thing. And third is this: God can and will deliver. God can and will deliver. In each situation, God not only can deliver, he doesn't only have the power to do so, but he accomplishes that deliverance. He gives them sweet water instead of bitter water. He gives them manna and quail instead of no food. He gives them water where there was no water, out of a rock. He gives them victory, and it clearly is going to be his victory over the Amalekites. It's nothing that the Israelites do, and he demonstrates that clearly. We'll talk about that this morning. And he gives Moses a way to, through Jethro, he gives Moses a way to shepherd these 2 million people in a way that makes sense, in a way that accomplishes what he desires to accomplish. So he can and will deliver. That doesn't mean, as I say that, it doesn't mean that it's always going to be deliverance the way we expect deliverance to be. I'm confident that Israel did not expect for Moses to pick up a log and throw it into bitter water and that water to become sweet. I'm sure that's not what they expected. I'm sure Israel didn't expect that Moses would walk up to a rock and smack it and there would water come out of that rock. I'm thinking they probably expected something different. I don't think the Israelites expected that the answer to their hunger problem would be that they would have this special stuff fall to the ground and they would go out and pick that up every morning for 6 mornings a week. I don't think that's how they expected the answer to their problem to come. Yet, God answered their situation and he answered it perfectly for them. So sometimes the answer won't come in the way that it's expected, but the answer deliverance will come. Sometimes, especially if you consider a physical infirmity, sometimes deliverance comes through healing. Sometimes deliverance comes through ultimate healing, which is in the presence of God himself. But God can and always does deliver. And he works everything for his glory and for our good. So those are the three things to remember as you're walking through all this. And that's the lesson. That is the lesson that Israel was being taught through these situations, so that when they get to Kadesh Barnea and they recognize that this is going to be a difficult situation, giants in the land, that's really difficulty. They made it bigger than it was, right? They made it bigger than it was, which they typically tended to do. They tended to make things bigger than it was. Remember, even when they were hungry, remember how they described their life in Egypt? Oh, that we were back in Egypt sitting before the meat pots and had bread to our fill. You know, they kind of exaggerated that a little bit. They were slaves in Egypt that did most of their life making bricks, and there probably wasn't a whole lot of meat pots they were sitting beside all day just, you know, munching on meat. That's not what was going on here. So they tended to exaggerate just a little bit. And so when you get to Kadesh Barnea, they're actually going to exaggerate quite a bit, that we're like grasshoppers to these big giants. Well, I don't think they're that tall, all right? I don't think that, you know, they may be twice as tall. If you consider what's going on, probably what's going on is the giants may have been between 8 and 9 feet tall. Israelite men at that point would have been 4.5 to 5 feet tall. So they're likely double, but that's not like grasshopper size, all right? I've seen a grasshopper, and a grasshopper isn't half my height. If I ever see a grasshopper that's half as big as me, I am running. I'm running away from that grasshopper because something Jurassic Park is happening, kids. It's going on. So So they tend to exaggerate. But the fact is, there was really difficulty. There were really going to be giants in the land. There was really going to be a reason, a hardship for them as they entered the land. So difficulty was going to be difficulty. But they were, needed to recognize that God had them exactly where he wanted them and that he would deliver them. He would deliver them. He would make good on his promise for them in the land. Unfortunately, we know Israel. They don't learn their lesson very well. In fact, they don't learn it at all. So when they get to Kadesh Barnea, Numbers 13, they're going to actually refuse to enter the land. And that's going to have terrible consequences for them. But we'll talk about that when we get there. But again, every one of these things is designed to help them, to build into them recognition that God, those three things we talked about. So now we find ourselves in Exodus chapter 17, verse 8. And this is the first military test of this new nation. You might say, well, no, it's not really. They had a military test at the sea, right? They had a military test at the sea because Pharaoh came out with his army against them. Well, okay, but they didn't lift a finger in that fight. They lifted no finger in that fight. All they did was run across the sea. All they did was run across the sea. God accomplished that when he let the sea come down on Pharaoh's armies and chariots and killed them that way. So this really is going to be the first military test, and it comes from the Amalekites. So let's just read a little bit first in Exodus 17, verse 8. Then Amalek, okay, I'm going to say it right. Then, okay, now it's in my head wrong, and I can't get it to come out right. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek while Moses and Aaron and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So let's set the stage. Now they're still on the way to the Sinai. Who are these Amalekites? Who are the Amalekites? Jamie? Not quite, not quite. You're close, though. They are related. They are related. Chris? Grandson of Esau. Amalek is the grandson of Esau, right? So you've got Jacob and Esau, right, brothers. So Amalek would be, the Amalekites would be cousins of Israel. They're cousins, you know, 450 times removed, but they're cousins, all right? They're cousins. They're related. And what's the big deal between Jacob and Esau, Israel and Amalek? What's the big deal? What's the issue that's going to be an issue for throughout all history for them? Birthright stolen. Not only that, but blessing stolen or seemed to be stolen. But remember, God promised when they were in the womb. When they were in the womb, God said, there are two nations in your belly, and the older will serve the younger. Right? That was the promise of God to Sarah, to Rebecca, for Isaac, for Jacob and Esau. And that then becomes a struggle, and it'll be a struggle throughout history, all the way up until Herod, right? It played itself out numerous times throughout the Old Testament, numerous times. It plays itself out here as Israel is coming out to go back up to the land. The Amalekites at this point were a nomadic kind of people. They hadn't settled necessarily completely into Mount Seir yet, which they're going to settle into there. They haven't completely settled in yet. They've become, and so they are going to attempt to take Israel out. I mean, and Israel is ripe for the picking right now. If you think about it, Israel is ripe for the picking because they're this nation that has just been, they are a slave nation that has basically spent their life making bricks, okay? They're not necessarily yet. I think there's training going on. I do believe that Moses was well-trained militarily because of his position in Pharaoh's court, in Pharaoh's house. I do believe that Moses had likely trained Joshua as a military, and I do think that in this time, probably while they were at that three-week period up at the springs, I believe there was military training going on. The reason I believe that is because when Moses tells Joshua, go select men out for us who can fight, Joshua doesn't say, how am I supposed to do that? We've got a bunch of brickmakers. We don't have anybody that can fight. Now, I think Joshua probably has already been doing some military training at this point. But if you consider 3 weeks of military training as opposed to a military force coming to conquer you, you really are ripe for the picking, right? It could be a bad deal for you. So that's where we find ourselves now. Now, the Amalekites, again, descendants of Esau. This is not the first or last. This is the first time we see them coming as the nation called Amalek. Not the last time we'll see them even against Israel here in the wilderness. In Numbers, they're going to come at him again. And on the way up to the promised land later on, they're going to ask, can we transit your land through the king's highway? The king's highway was a traditional way to pass through land that was wide open for everybody. And they ask, can we just walk through your land? And Amalek says to Israel, no, you can't. Go around. And Israel says, but we won't even get off the road. We'll stay on the road. We won't touch a bit of your land. We won't do any kind of problem to your land. And Amalek says, no, in fact, if you enter land, we will kill you. And so they make them go around. So there's still bad blood between Israel and Amalek, or Jacob and Esau. That's going to actually be displayed later on when you get to the kings, First Kings, with Saul and Agag. That's Israel and Amalek. It's going to be displayed later on in Esther with Haman, or I should do Mordecai and Haman, Israel and Amalek. Okay, and it's going to be displayed later on with Jesus and Herod, Israel and Amalek. So it's going to fall. Now, it's not happening today. There's no struggle between Israel and Amalek, Jacob and Esau today. You know why there's no struggle between the two of them today? Because the Amalekites are wiped from there. There's no trace of their race anywhere on the earth anymore. They're gone. Yeah, Mike? It made the journey more difficult, and I think it was a willful attempt on Amalek. I can't say that word this morning. I don't know why. You know what I'm saying. If I say Amalek, you know what I'm saying. I think it's an attempt to exterminate them. I think it's what it is, actually, because it's going to make them go through desert, and really not a nice place at all. So I think that's what's going on, too. I agree. So I just wanted to indicate the bad blood between these two people. It's not just this nation came up and said, hey, we're going to fight the Israelites. No, these are Esau's descendants who still feel wronged by the Israelites, and they're coming out to exact vengeance on Israel. That's what they're going to do. And the attempt, their desire is to wipe them out. They're coming against a somewhat trained, but I don't think well-trained army. Okay, they're coming against that. In fact, there's not even a standing army yet. I think that's a big deal. That's important to recognize. There is no standing army yet because Moses doesn't say, Joshua, get the army together. He says, go find guys for us who can fight. That's a big difference between get the army together. That's a big difference. And so I don't think there's a standing army yet. This is the first real military test they're going to have, and yet God is going to deliver them in a miraculous way. So you have Joshua doing that. So look at verse 10. Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So here's what happens. In the valley, there's going to be a fight. Moses, Aaron, and Hur are going to go up. And what Moses knows to do, and I believe revealed to him by God, I don't think he's making this up, although we don't have it anywhere where God said, raise your staff in the air and you'll prevail. Lower your staff and you won't prevail. Moses figures that out as time passes because he goes up the hill and he's on top. Joshua and the ragtag army, if you will, is down in the valley, and there's a battle going on. Amalek is coming up against Israel. Israel is fighting really for their life at this point. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur are up on the top of the hill looking over the place, and Moses has his staff in the air. Okay? Well, as you're standing there with your staff in the air, sometimes your arms get tired when you're holding him up like this, right? And maybe he's holding it up like this. I don't know how he's holding the staff up. I'm thinking it probably is like this because of the way it's described later on. So he probably has his staff in the air like this, holding it up. And after a while, his arms get tired. And he's a man. He is not God. He is not a God. He's a man. And so his arms get tired, and he lowers the staff to rest his arms a little bit. Well, what happens, and this is what the text says, I'm kind of moving through without reading it. The text says, whenever Moses lowered his staff, the Amalekites, I don't know why I can't say that word today, the Amalekites would prevail. And so when Moses raised his staff back up, then Joshua and the Israelites would prevail. So Moses recognized there's an issue here. Is it because Joshua was somehow looking at that staff and saying, okay, it's up, fight hard, guys. No, this is clearly a demonstration that God was the one who was in this battle. This is a living example for them to recognize God's deliverance for them in this situation, that this wasn't about their military prowess. It wasn't about how well they could fight. This was God fighting for them, and I think this is a visible way for them to recognize this is God fighting for us, because he gives them this lesson. Whenever Moses' arms go down, the Amalekites prevail. Whenever his go up, well, Moses gets tired and he can't do it anymore. So Aaron and Hur do something really smart. They find a stone and they roll it somehow. They find a boulder and they bring it in and they put it underneath so Moses can sit down. And then Moses puts his hands in the air. Aaron gets on one side, Hur gets on the other, and they hold his arms up for the duration of the battle. And at that point, because his arms stay up, Joshua and the Israelites prevail over the Amalekites. They win the battle. And it wasn't just a few minutes. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. So there's this great victory. And here's how we know that it wasn't just about a military victory, because God now tells Moses to do something specific regarding the victory and regarding the outcome. He says, do this. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek. Man, Amalek, I cannot say the word. From under heaven. So he says to Moses, write it down, tell Joshua, here's the deal, I'm going to utterly blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven. I'm going to blot them out. They're going to be gone. Now, he doesn't do that immediately. There are several efforts made to accomplish that. Saul was supposed to have done it, didn't follow through. Esther and Mordecai try to do it. They don't get it done. But by the time of 2nd century, 3rd century, they're gone. Herod and his descendants are the Edomites, Amalekites, and they are the last remnants of this race. That is why it's amazing. Herod was acting as king over the Jews. Why do you think he did all the building projects that he did, built a temple for the Jews? Because he knew the Jews hated him. And he's trying to endear himself to them by building them this temple. The Jews would never respond to a Edomite king. And so he's trying to, and they never really did. They never liked him. He was just a friend of Caesar's, and got this position because of his friendship with Caesar, if you trace the history. So there's this promise that they will be blotted out, and that actually does happen. There are no Amalekites on the earth today. None alive on the earth today. No one can trace their heritage back to Esau. They're done. God does accomplish this on the earth. So then Moses builds an altar and calls it, the Lord is my banner, saying, a hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have a war with Amalek from generation to generation. So So what Moses does now is he builds an altar and he inscribes on the altar, "The Lord is my banner," or Yahweh Nissi, N-I-S-S-I. So what is the significance of the Lord being the banner? What is the significance of that? The significance of that is the Lord is the one, the standard. The Lord is the one who goes out for them before them in battle. The Lord is the one who is really fighting the battle for them. They're not going out in the name of Moses. They're not going out in the name of Joshua. They're not even going out in the name of Israel. They're not fighting for their own nation. They're going out in the name of Yahweh. He is the banner. He is the standard that they're fighting underneath. And if you consider fighting underneath the banner of Yahweh, is there any enemy that's too difficult for him to overcome? The answer to that is no, and he demonstrated it right here. He demonstrated it right here. This ragtag, poorly trained, or I won't say poorly trained, let's just say not yet well-trained army, is able to defeat the Amalekites through this miracle of God by Moses having his staff in the air, clearly a demonstration of God's deliverance for Israel. Was the difficulty really difficulty? Absolutely was. The Amalekites were trying to wipe them off the face of the earth. That's a real problem. That's a real problem. They couldn't just say, "Well, it's not a big deal. They're just the Amalekites." They couldn't say that. It was a real problem. But they needed to recognize that they were right where God wanted them and that he would deliver them. And he does that. And he shows them his deliverance miraculously by the holding up of the staff above Moses' head. And so he gives them this as a memorial from generation to generation. He gives them this as a something to remember that he's going to defeat and wipe out the Amalekites, but not just that, that he is their banner. He is the one who's actually fighting for them. I think that probably David has this in mind when he goes out to fight Goliath and he says, "You're not fighting against me. The battle's not mine. The battle is the Lord's." David understands Jehovah or Yahweh Nissi. He understands the Lord is my banner, and that's how he's fighting. All of Israel didn't understand that. The rest of Israel's army didn't understand that, and they're scared to death of Goliath and the Philistines. But David understood it, and David took that the Lord is my banner seriously and goes out and fights in the name of God against the Philistines. In this first military situation, God delivers them miraculously and demonstrates his power to accomplish that deliverance, something they should have remembered when they get to Kadesh Barnea, because the problem is going to be, their big fear as we get to Numbers 13 is not going to be the land's not good. No, they're going to say the land is great. The land is great. It's a land that flows with coffee and honey. It's a great land. It says milk, I know. That's one thing that I don't understand. But there's it's this great land, grapes cluster so big that two men have to carry the grape cluster. But the big deal, the big reason they won't go in is, but there are giants in the land and they will overwhelm us and destroy us. That's the issue. They should have pointed back to this day and said, and I think that's what Joshua and Caleb do. They point back to this day and they say, no, God will accomplish this. God can accomplish this. Let's go. Let's go in. We need to go in and take this land. But the rest of Israel says, no, God can't accomplish that. And they refuse to enter. And that results in grave consequences for that generation, which we'll talk about another day. So again, three things, difficulty, really difficulty. God had him right where he wanted him. And God did deliver miraculously. Again, show him that. Now we come to chapter 18. We're almost to Sinai now. We're nearly there. We're on the last stretch. We've had where bitter water became sweet. We've had where no food turned into food. We've had where no water was turned into water. We've had where this no army was turned into an army. And now we have the last situation really is going to set up the way that Moses is going to lead the people throughout the rest of the wilderness. And we're reintroduced to somebody here in chapter 18, and it's Jethro. So the last letter E on your notes is Jethro. Jethro, who's the priest of Midian, this is chapter 18, verse 1, Moses' father-in-law heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel's people, how the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt. Now Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, had taken Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her home, along with her two sons. The name of the one son was Gershom, for he said, I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. And the other one is Eliezer, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. So now we're reintroduced to Jethro. So what happened? Okay, Jethro is the priest of Midian. It's possible because he's introduced to us earlier in the book as Reuel, right? His name is Reuel. And now he's Jethro. There are several possibilities for that. I choose the possibility that guys in those days had more than one name, typically. I mean, look at Jacob. Jacob was Esau. No, Jacob was Israel. Okay, we're going to stop right here and get a drink of coffee. Jacob was not Esau. Jacob was Israel. Okay, Esau was Edom. Very possible that Reuel could have been Jethro. I'm going with that one. Some folks suggested that Reuel was the grandfather, Jethro was the father, and so that's how it works. Reuel was the patriarch of the family, Jethro was underneath him, and then now Reuel has died, and so Jethro is now the patriarch. I'm going to go with just the potential of two names. That seems to be a way that it happens. But we do know this. He's introduced to us as twice as Moses' father-in-law, right? Twice as Moses' father-in-law. So remember, Moses, at 40 years old, kills the Egyptian, thinking he's going to rally the Israelites to leave Egypt. When he goes to rally the Israelites, they say, who made you king over us, buddy? What are you going to do, kill us like you killed the Egyptians? So now the word gets out. Moses flees Pharaoh and goes to Midian, meets Zipporah and her sisters, delivers them from the marauders, the shepherds who are trying to steal their water. The girls go home, say, hey, cool, we're home early because we got, and Reuel or Jethro says, hey, go get him and bring him here, and gives Zipporah his daughter to Moses, and they have two sons. The first son's name is Gershom, the second son's name is Eliezer. This is the first time we see Eliezer's name, first time. Back in earlier in Exodus, it is Gershom that is at focus, the oldest son, the firstborn is at focus because of the firstborn thing going on with Israel's my firstborn, and God saying to Moses, basically he's going to kill Moses because Moses hasn't circumcised his firstborn, hasn't really shown care for God at that point. And then he also tells Pharaoh that I'm going to take your firstborn. So all this firstborn stuff is significant there. Here we're introduced to the secondborn, who is Eliezer. Their names mean something. Gershom means I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. And Eliezer is actually, I think, pointing back to that first trip out of Egypt. Not this second trip. He doesn't know. When Eliezer is born, Moses doesn't know what God is going to do in delivering the people from Egypt. He doesn't know that yet. But he does know that when he left Midian, he was delivered from the sword of Pharaoh. Pharaoh wanted to kill him, remember, because of his killing the Egyptian. Pharaoh wanted to kill him. And so he's delivered from the sword of Pharaoh, and he names his second son Eliezer, meaning the Lord has delivered me from Pharaoh's sword. So that points back to that first trip out of Egypt, not this exodus out of Egypt. Okay, so it's probably not a big deal, but I wanted to make sure we got it right in our head. So his sons are both a reminder to him. When he sees his sons, they're both reminders of God's first deliverance of him out of Egypt into Midian and into that situation of his life, into that area where he became the shepherd. So Moses' father-in-law comes. Apparently what has happened is, remember on the trip to Egypt, Zipporah and his sons, I think both sons, even though only one is mentioned, both sons are with him on the trip to Egypt. At some point while he's in Egypt, he sends Zipporah and his sons back to Midian. He sends them back. How do we know that? Because the Bible tells us that. It says this. It says, now Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, had taken Zipporah, Moses' wife after he had sent her home along with her two sons. So Moses apparently sent Zipporah home at some point during the plague time. Zipporah goes back to Midian, okay? So that's where she is. And Jethro now, hearing what's going on, knowing they've been released, knowing they're out, have been delivered, he now goes back to Moses, and I think he's doing it for a purpose, to bring Zipporah and the sons back to Moses, because that's where they should be. That's where they should be. She's his wife. They're his kids. They should be back with him. So that's what he's doing. He's bringing them back. He's bringing them back too. And they meet in the wilderness. And there's a good meeting that goes on. Let's just read. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness where he was encamped at the mountain of God. So now, actually, they have made it to Sinai. They're encamped at the mountain of God. Jethro knows that, and he is now coming to them, and he's bringing Zipporah and the sons to them. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him, and they asked each other their welfare and went into the tent. So they greet each other. How you doing? Great. How you doing? Great. Let's go sit down. And now Jethro is going to have a heart-to-heart with Moses, and they're going to talk about what's going on. So first thing Moses is going to do is share with him everything that happened. Jethro has heard it, and I'm sure has heard rumors and heard some of the things. This is big news. Big news. Pharaoh was really the leader of the world at that point. And for Pharaoh to be overcome by anything would have been really big news in all of the land. And so now all the land is hearing about it. And Jethro, being part of that, has heard about it. And so now he goes, and Moses is actually going to tell him all that he had done. This is verse 8. Then Moses told his father-in-law all the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and the hardship that had come upon them in the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. So now Moses is going to rehearse to Jethro not only the deliverance from Egypt, but he's also going to talk about the deliverance from each one of those individual hardships. He's going to walk through Marah. He's going to walk through the manna. He's going to walk through Massah and Meribah. He's going to walk through Jehovah or Yahweh Nissi. He's going to walk through all that and tell Jethro, this is how God has delivered us. This is how God has delivered us. And Jethro responds this way. Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, out of the hand of Pharaoh, and has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians." And this is Jethro, who wasn't even there, wasn't even walking through this. This is his conclusion after hearing about the deliverance. "Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, because in this affair they dealt arrogantly with the people." So now, as Jethro hears this, he says, "Now I know that the Lord, Yahweh, is greater than all gods." What was the lesson that Israel should have learned? That God, Yahweh, was greater than all gods. They didn't get it, but Jethro did. Jethro did. So what did Jethro and Moses do? Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God. Aaron came with the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. This is pre-priesthood, so it's not wrong for Jethro. In fact, Jethro was a priest in Midian. He's not a Jew anyway, to be offering this sacrifice. And so even though Aaron comes along with, Aaron's not a priest yet. Aaron is not a priest yet. Moses, there's nothing special yet with Levi. That hasn't happened yet. The law is not in place. Exodus 18, Exodus 19, the law is not in place. And so you actually see the old patriarchal system happening here, where Jethro represents the family to God by offering sacrifice. That's what Job was doing. Remember, Job does that. Job offers sacrifices every day for each one of his kids. That's I think, in effect, what Jethro is doing here is, as the patriarch, really, and so he is, in some sense, of his family, he is the patriarch, and now he is offering sacrifice for his family as a blessing to God. Not, this is not a sin-covering sacrifice. This is a blessing sacrifice. This is a sacrifice that says, thank you for your deliverance, God. Let us give you this sacrifice in return. The covering sacrifice, the atoning sacrifice, those kinds of sacrifices are not instituted yet. They're not instituted yet. They won't be until post-Exodus 20. That's when they start getting instituted. And we'll spend time with them after we get to Exodus 20. But this is not the priesthood, temple kind of sacrifice or tabernacle kind of sacrifice, because the tabernacle doesn't exist. The brazen altar doesn't exist. The laver doesn't exist. The table of showbread doesn't exist. The candlestick inside the holy place doesn't exist. The Ark of the Covenant doesn't exist. None of that exists yet. Okay? It's going to happen, at least on the earth. At least on the earth. I believe it does exist in heaven. Hebrews tells us that. And the stuff on earth is just a shadow of what's already in heaven. But on the earth, it does not yet exist. Does not yet exist. So this is a different sacrifice than what you would normally read after Exodus 20. So the next day then, after we have this meeting, this recounting of what's going on, now Moses goes out to judge the people. And so what judging the people isn't is guilty. That's not what's going on. It's actually Moses is going to hear complaints. Moses is going to hear complaints or situations between people. You've got 2 million people. Not everybody's going to get along all the time, right? Not everybody's going to. So who is the leader of the people? Well, Moses is the leader of the people. And so he would sit down, apparently, because it says he would sit down and they would come to him and they would bring their complaints. They would bring their situations, and Moses then would say, okay, give him $500 and you're fine, whatever would happen. He would be the one educating all of that. I said the word right, I think I did. All that stuff, he'd be the one doing that. And so it became this, it was a huge burden upon him to accomplish that. The next day, Moses sat to judge the people and all the people around Moses from morning till evening. So all day. When Moses' father-in-law saw what he was doing with the people, he said, what is this that you're doing for the people? Why do you sit down alone and all the people around you stand around you from morning till evening? And Moses said to his father, because the people have come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, they come to me and I decide between one person and another. I make them know the statutes of God and his laws. Moses' father-in-law said to him, what you're doing is not good. I love that. What you're doing is not good. You and all the people with you will certainly wear yourselves out, for the thing is too heavy for you. You're not able to do it alone. Now, obey my voice and I will give you advice, and God will be with you. You shall represent the people. Did I see a hand? Yes, Ron.
Biggest bureaucracy, but again, back inside the palace, all Moses probably knew was the top-down approach to leading. So.
Right. Yeah, if you understand where Moses is coming from a situation where Pharaoh was the guy, and that's what Moses is known as leadership. The Pharaoh didn't delegate inside the palace. Pharaoh didn't delegate. He didn't say, okay, you guys make the decision. No, he made the decision, and if you violated his decision, you would be killed. That's how it worked. So, and there is, in some sense, a transference of what Moses learned in the palace to what he's doing here. You see, Pharaoh was considered God, and for Egypt was the representation of all of Egypt's God on earth. And so when he spoke, I mean, this is a classic Eastern kind of understanding of a king. When he spoke, it was as if God himself were speaking. It was as if God himself were speaking. That transfers even to like the laws of the Medes and Persians. Why couldn't the laws of the Medes and Persians be changed? Because the king of the Medes and Persians was considered to be God himself, and God can't make a mistake. And so you can't change the decree of the king. You can't change that decree. That's what's going on later in Daniel. But I think it draws its history back to even what's going on with Pharaoh as that absolute representation of God on earth. Well, you see that a little bit here in what Moses says. You see a little bit of that what Moses says, because Moses says, they come to me and I make known to them the laws of God and his statutes. So he's saying, not that I'm God on earth, but I'm representing God to these people. That's what I'm doing. I'm representing God to these people. So Moses, I don't think it's Moses saying, I got to do this. This is me. But Moses had never seen delegation in progress. He had never, process. He had never seen delegation. Pharaoh didn't delegate. And so Moses, as the leader of the people, I don't think he's being proud or being, I got to do this. He's just, this is how he's seen it done. And so he's doing it the way he's seen it done, not recognizing that he's wearing himself out. And Jethro, I don't think it's an accident that he's here. I don't think it's an accident that Jethro shows up when he does, where he does, at this time, because now Jethro says, hey, what you're doing isn't good, man. What you're doing isn't good. Listen to me. I'm going to give you some advice. Just hear me out. I'm going to give you some advice. And so what he tells Moses to do is, ooh, we're really late. I'm sorry. I completely lost track of time. I really wanted to get through this morning, though. Okay, we're going to stop because it's 46, and there's no way I can get through the rest of Jethro in 46, so in 4 minutes or so. So we'll stop here, we'll finish this, and we'll actually start Israel at Sinai next week and go from there. My traveling days are done for a long, long time, I hope, I pray. So I should be here. You can get sick of me, and I'll get happy with you. So let's pray, and then we'll finish up. Lord, thank you for your faithfulness to Israel. Thank you for your faithfulness to your people, and thank you for your faithfulness to us as a body, us as a people, and thank you for your faithfulness to me. I pray that you would, as we walk through Israel, that you would help us to recognize our own lack of trust on occasion, our own doubts that we let rise to the top, and that we would recognize that you're at work. You have us exactly where you want us. You're accomplishing your purpose perfectly to prepare us for whatever it is you have for us down the road. Lord, just thank you for this lesson in Israel. We ask this in your name. Amen. Thanks. You're dismissed. Appreciate it.